Good morning and welcome to CSIS on a beautiful Friday morning. We're very privileged today to have with us James Wolfenson, who will many of you know very well from his very prominent public service over the years. This is our first in a series of sessions looking at what we're calling China's smart power. And it derives from an initiative here at CSIS called the Smart Power Initiative, building off of work that Joe Nye and others had done, looking at American influence, non-economic, non-coercive, but more normative influence in the world. And this is looking at China's increasing normative influence. The story that many of us know of China is incredible economic growth, and some of us look at it, the military growth. This is really looking at China's influence writ large in the world and increasing attractiveness or non-attractiveness to the rest of the world as either an alternative to the United States or as something besides the United States. But we're very pleased to kick this off with James Wolfenson because of his tremendous perspective, not only on China, but on the issues that we're looking at today. And this is obviously a very unique time to have somebody with his background be looking at, be coming and talking to us about China. He is currently the chair of Wolfenson & Company, which is an investment and international advisory group to companies and governments around the world. He is concurrently chair of Citi's International Advisory Board. And most of us know him from his service as the ninth president of the World Bank between 1995 and 2005, during which, on his watch, China became the largest customer of the bank. His background before that was as an international investment banker, but we won't give him credit for credit default swaps or hold him up for anything other than esteem today, because really his service has been quite extraordinary over the years. Just if you look at what happened on his watch with respect to the bank and China, the number of projects which looked at improving China's environmental situation, energy conservation, rural infrastructure development, and health issues. Really, in many respects, what the bank was doing was at least a decade ahead of its time. And if you look at all of the concerns that the leadership in Beijing has laid out for their top challenges, they're all issues with which the bank was intimately involved as early as the mid-90s. And so this really is an extraordinary opportunity to look at both where we've come from, and then look forward. So without further ado, let me introduce James Wolfenson. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Freeman, and thank you for the invitation, and thank you for the opportunity of essentially bringing myself up to date with China. When I was at the World Bank, it was, as you might imagine, one of the central focuses of the institution. Largely because at that time it was a very large country, a country which in the mid-90s was emerging strongly but with considerable issues in terms of funding and in terms of the direction in which they were going. And there was an intimate relationship at that time between the bank and that country. And my wife and I had the opportunity of visiting several times and really learning a bit about this remarkable giant. It was, for us, not the first time. We were there initially in 1974 when I was working for a British financial group, and we did the very first wheat financing for China. And that was a different time. A very drab time for those of you that had been in China at the time. The The capital was very different than it is today. Shanghai was very different than it is today. It was a hugely different atmosphere, and one could hardly have anticipated the remarkable development which one has seen since then. But it was with great joy that we went back again and were astonished, as I'm sure many of you have been, who have visited that country, at the extraordinary developments that have occurred. Just in this morning's New York Times, there is a headline which says, "Once sizzling, China's economy shows rapid signs of fizzling." And that's a typical headline from a newspaper. But Stephen Green of Standard and Chartered Bank is reported as saying that the three engines of growth, exports, investment, and consumptions, have all slowed down. That in the fourth quarter, there'll be a 5.8% rate of growth, down from what you all know was an 11% growth last year, and a consistent 30-year period of 10% growth or better. China has been a remarkable performer, and so I thought what might be useful, given that you're going to have six or seven contributions in this lecture series, and given that probably the other six or seven speakers have great insights and great currency in their views, what I might try and do is to set a framework for you of where I see the country having been. But more importantly, given that the title of this series is to look forward, is to try and make some projections on where I see China going and what is the changing balance that we're likely to see. It's interesting also that you put this in the context of a China in a global century. And a global century probably is worth just a minute to talk about, because I think it's very important, and I'll get into it, that we move away from the typical east-west-north-south division in which I grew up, and which, looking around the room, some others will have grown up, as the way in which we divided the world, to a different sort of world which has emerged, and in particular a world in which there are winners and losers, and where, at least in terms of the analysis that I'm comfortable with, we look at it as a four-speed world. And I'll get into that as well. So my purpose in trying to start this series is to start first with some numbers, although I won't dazzle you with too many, but try and evoke for you some important changes that I think you need to have as a background when you start to look at this subject. The facts are that until 2007, there were really a dominant group of countries, starting, of course, after World War II. We had a dominant United States, we had a Marshall Plan, we had a reach out of American resources, and a gradual accession to a group of countries of the G7 that have regarded themselves and have been regarded as the sort of dominant center in the economic activity of our planet. That group of countries, which we call typically now the affluent countries, have had a remarkable history and have retained their centrality and their significant economic dominance for quite a long period of time. There are some 30 of them, and they're countries that you're very familiar with. The G7, of course, plus other countries as varied as Korea and Sweden and Taiwan and the Arab Emirates and so on. Those countries have been the countries that, until 2007 at least, had close to 75% of the global GDP. Then there were a group of countries, including China and India, which we call the globalizers. They're the countries that were not enormous in their size in terms of their economic activity. They happen to have been very large in size in terms of population. And those countries, for quite a period of time, were the countries which, in terms of their share of global GDP was around 14-15%. Then there was another group of countries, which we call the rentier countries. They're countries that had less than 3.5% growth. These other countries countries which had a growth rate of more than 3.5%, those are the Chinas and the Indias that I spoke of. They had income around between $875 and some $14,000, and there are a bunch of them. And then there is a group of countries which are the laggards. They're the countries which include specifically and particularly Africa, but not limited to Africa, which are at the bottom of the heap, and they have just about 1.5 to 2% of the global GDP. So we had a world which had 75% for the rich countries, a bunch of countries, India and China included, 14.5%, a bunch of countries which we call the rentier countries, which are around 8%, and then a bunch of countries, a large number, which were at 2%. And that was the world that I grew up in, and it was the world that I think we weren't comfortable with, but everyone knew their position in that world. And you were in the G7. If you were in the G7, you had lots of money. And if you were African, the chances were you were perceived as both being poor and a fair chance that you were perceived as being corrupt. I don't say that in any nasty way, but that was the way the world looked at it. And that was true in 65, and not big changes in 2007. Some advances in terms of countries in the so-called rentier group. And then we get to today, and we start to look at the future, which is the subject of this exercise. And I should tell you, by the way, by way of background, that it wasn't always that way. In 1500 and in 1815, India and China were close to 50% of the global GDP. 50% of the global GDP. Immediately after World War II, and in the period that I've been describing, they were 4-5%, and then grew to 9%, and they were part of that group of countries that was, as I told you, 14-15% of the world's GDP. But everybody knew their place. If you're in the G7, you're one of the big guys. If you tried to get in, like Russia, you were admitted, as I saw with my own eyes, sometimes for a meeting here, and then asked to stand outside, and then asked to come in, and then asked to stand outside. I could never understand why the Russians took that. Certainly the finance minister did. President Putin did not. So it became a G8 some of the time. And that was the world that really I acceded to when I came to the World Bank. But we started to see differences occurring. And for those of you here, and I know many of you or most of you are very familiar with China, you saw a change in the face of China and a change in the economic development of China. A face that was remarkably more beautiful in terms of the sense that we looked at it, not as drab as the earlier periods, exciting. The development of the cities was quite remarkable. And we started to look at the future, and the future holds a very different breakdown of the global GDP. Instead of 75% of the GDP going to the G7, G8, by 2025, their share is reduced to 55%, and by 2050, to 32%. This is a precipitous drop in terms of the way in which we look at the world. And the most dramatic other movement is the movement of what we call the globalizers, which includes China and India. And they move from the 14%, which they have now, to a figure of 60%. So instead of the 75% for the rich countries, which we got used to, and 25% for all the rest, all of a sudden we find that a group of countries, which includes principally India and China as the two great motive forces in that group, gets to 60% of the global GDP. And together, by the way, with the United States, become the dominant powers in our planet. That is a significant reversal on the way in which I used to look at things as I started in my career, and certainly the way in which I think many of you did. China will move from 6% of global GDP to 21% of global GDP, and India, at a slower trajectory, but will get to 25% of global GDP. It's a sort of movement like this, and then turns up in the last 25 years, China is more direct to that level. So between China and India, we're back to pretty much what we had in 1815 and what we had in 1500, which is the two countries with roughly 50% of the global GDP. Of course, in terms of population, they remain they remain very large. In terms of the numbers, I think you're familiar with them. China grows to 1.4 billion. India grows from its 1.1 billion today to 1.8 billion. Will be the largest country in the world by 2050. And the G7 countries, as you all know, in that world, which will then be a world of roughly 9 billion people, growing from more or less 6.5 billion today. The G7, or the rich countries, the affluent countries, grow by a bit less than 100 million people from what they are in the year 2000. The other countries grow by 2.9 billion, in moving from 6 to 9 billion. So we have this unbelievable shift in terms of the world. We're used to 75% of global GDP for the rich countries. That drops to 35%. We used to, some of us in the past, pitying or patronizing India, China. They now become nearly 50% of the global GDP. And the world in which we're operating grows from 6 billion to 9 billion. And the countries that grow are, of course, the India and China. But there is one other factor which is hugely important and which we all need to understand, which is that Africa and a few other countries grow roughly from 1 billion to 2 point something billion. They get to 25% of the global population. And that population is bypassed in terms of economic wealth and in terms of its benefits. Just to give you an idea of the way that world in 2050 shapes up, the rich countries, your children and grandchildren, will have more or less $95,000 a year of income. The children and grandchildren of our Chinese and Indian cousins will move up to between $40,000 and $45,000 per capita income, up significantly from the $1,000 to $2,000 where it sits today. At the bottom of the pile is Africa, and that grows from more or less $700 to $800 per capita to the large sum of $1,800 per capita. So we then have a world, very rich countries, $95,000, China and India, $45,000, a bunch of other countries, $12,000 or so, and then 2 billion people sitting at the bottom of the scale with, according to these numbers, $1,800 per capita. Now, maybe that wouldn't matter in a world where these people are either uninformed or lost, but according to the statistics that I got this morning, there are today 3.5 billion cell phones out there. And for any of you that visit Africa, you will know that whether you go to a little village out in the countryside or whether you're in a town, you see people with earpieces and you see them with cellular phones. And so the issue of knowing what is going on, as distinct from my first trips to Africa in 1959, 1960, where there was a distinct difference when you're in the bush or whether you're in the town, or whether you had any information or you had no information, you now have this lateral distribution throughout Africa of information. So you'll have 2 billion people or so around Africa 25% of the global population at $1,700 per capita, and you'll have the rest of us at $40,000 and $95,000. And it's a mobile world, and it's a world also where there are people who are prepared to take advantage of disturbances and discrepancies between access to resources. And it presents, for me anyway, a very serious challenge in terms of Africa's own development, and indeed, to me, a very serious challenge in terms of global stability and peace. But let me get back from Africa and deal with the question now that I was asked to deal with, which is the issue between the United States and China. But let me put a postscript which is really important, that you can talk about the US and China, but to project forward without thinking about India is not a balanced view of the future. I'm not going to talk about India today, but I just put the postscript that India by 2050 will be a larger country than China, is projected to have a larger income than China by 2050. Whether that is true or not, it's certainly directionally correct. And that you can't really look just at China and India, at China and the United States, without at least understanding that beside you there is another significant power, both in terms of people and in terms of economic weight, which is India, which is just down the street. And so I will talk about China and the United States, because that's the subject, but I ask you to keep in mind when you're thinking about it, to put a postscript in about India, which today may not be important, but on all projections by 2050 will be. Now, what is it that we've seen in China in terms of the development progress? Well, I think you know that in the last 30 years, the years of the new government, if you like, or the new approach to governance in China, you had 600 million people taken out of poverty. That's a remarkable achievement. It's a remarkable achievement in terms of moving them above a dollar and a quarter to get them out of poverty. The level of the under 250 is still 50% of China. So it's 60% of China. So the actual movement forward in terms of the country has been dramatic, but there are still a lot of people in China who, as you will see from the disturbances that occur and from the nature of the country if you travel around it, clearly have not shared in the boom. China's become a trading power. It's come from number 30 to number 3 in that period of time of that 30 years, and is really remarkable in terms of its growth. Its growth in terms of economics, its growth in terms of the statistics, but not perhaps the growth in terms of the quality of life of the great number of people in the country. The consumption growth of the country is nowhere near the consumption growth of countries like ours. In our country, consumption represents 60% of the GDP. In the UK, it's 63%. In India, it's 56%. In China, consumption is 35%. It is a number which has declined significantly since the year 2000, but it's indicative of what you need to look at if you're looking at the economic content of China and you're making a comparison between China and our country. The second thing I wanted to take a quick look at was the issue of unemployment. There is, as I think you know, an enormous increase in urbanization in China. It's projected to increase in terms of the people in the urban areas from 39% in 2002 to 60% by 2020. That is a hell of a shift when you talk about multiplying it by 1.3 billion, 1.4 billion, 1.5 billion, 1 million people. And so you're having this unbelievable shift from the country into the cities. And by the way, in the last days, there has been announcements about reforms of the system of ownership of land in the countries, in the countryside, which may make it easier because it'll allow provision of transfer of properties between people in the countryside. Everything has been, the government has tried very hard to stop this momentum, but it's clear that they have not succeeded. And it is a fact that you're going to find this huge reduction in the rural population. This has led to a very big issue of unemployment. Because when you're on the farm, you can be working. When you come to the cities, you start getting counted in terms of unemployment. And so in China, with a GDP growth in 2007 of 12%, you had 9.2% unemployment, according to the Chinese statistics. In our country, we only had a 2% growth in that year, but we had 4.5% unemployment. There's a hell of a big difference between 4.5% and 9.2%. For many people, full employment is somewhere between 3% and 4%. When you get to 9%, you have a problem. And so that issue is one that is coming and most assuredly hitting the people in the place. And Hu Jintao last year stated that unemployment was actually his top concern, and that was emphasized and displayed also by my friend David Dollar, who worked with us in the World Bank and whom I think now heads the China office, if I'm not mistaken, of the World Bank in China. Beyond the unemployment, with the downturn that we have now seen in economic activity, given the remarkable involvement of China and its development of its export markets, we've seen up to date this year 68,000 businesses being closed in China, just up to date this year. By the way, all of you, I'm sure, are skilled in China, and so you don't get amazed by these numbers, but every time I see numbers in relation to China, I just go crazy because they typically, in my years at the World Bank, you'd have China, which would have 68,000. You'd look at the rest of the world, it would have 30,000 or 40,000 or 50,000. China alone in these things is a dramatic factor. And so 68,000 companies already this year have closed their doors. And so you have the unemployment, you have the companies closing their doors, and then you have what is clearly an issue, which is the widening inequality for those people that result in China, with the Gini coefficient going from 2.6 to 1 in 1978 to 3.3 to 1 in 2006. I should admit to you that in 10 years at the World Bank, I never really understood what the Gini coefficient was. I quoted it regularly, as I'm quoting it to you, and I just want you to know that if you ask a question on it, I will pass it to my colleague here so that he can explain to you what the Gini coefficient means. But it does mean the difference in some way between the focus of the earnings and the income that people have in the country. And the higher the number, the worse it is. That's all you need to know if you want to be president of the World Bank. Beyond that, you can work for the State Department or something. So we have going on there these factors in China, a growing issue of poverty, an issue of consumption, as I told you, and then the issue of unemployment. There are other issues in China, however you evaluate them. Political repression, environmental damage, corruption, they're all things which have led to considerable social unrest inside the country. And for those of you that know the country, certainly represent factors. In 2005, there were 84,000 disturbances involving 15 or more people. I said to some of my colleagues who I asked to get some stuff for me, why the hell do you only give me 2005? What was the number in 2007, 2008? And they said they've stopped giving the numbers because the issue of social disturbance is still a significant issue in that country, and not surprisingly so. And as you read from the press, some of these disturbances get quite large, and there has been a pretty degree of space given to people in China in recent times, not only before the Olympics, but I think consistently, but it is a very, very serious issue that needs to be faced. Wen Xiaobao said just the other day, he said, we must be crystal clear that without a certain pace of economic growth, there will be difficulties with employment, fiscal revenues and social development, and factors damaging social stability will grow. So it's not something that is not understood by the Chinese leadership. It's something that is clearly understood, and from my personal knowledge, is certainly something which is of concern to them. When the World Bank meetings were held, I met with the Chinese representatives, and they were here. They talked about the need, they talked at that stage about 9% growth and then a minimum 8% growth, which is a figure that many people use in the literature as being an area that you need to get to have social stability. They got to create 20 million jobs a year. 20 million jobs a year is not a trivial number. It is bigger than more than half the countries in the world just being added every year. So the creation of jobs is something that they need to do, and for that they think they need 8% to be able to keep the economic activity moving forward. Well, that seems now to be something that is to be challenged, particularly in light of the development which has occurred, which is the growing interdependence between China and developed countries around the world, not least the United States, in terms of the way in which our two countries have worked together. It's clear that they provide a lot of stuff for us. The figures of Chinese exports to the United States have grown dramatically. We continue to export some of our more elite products to them, and products which have been certainly admired by the Chinese and have been purchased. But their greatest contribution to us has, of course, been buying our treasury bills. And that has been a purchase that they have made, which we have become more and more dependent. The numbers are really quite dramatic for those of you that don't follow them. When I was in the business in terms of helping China, we were making loans to China from the World Bank to assist them in every sort of project. And we got it up to $3 billion a year, and we were regularly doing $3 billion a year to China in a variety of projects. And when I went there, I felt pretty important. They made me feel pretty important. And I was pretty important. I was president of the World Bank. Except that today, China has $1.8 to $1.9 trillion of reserves. $1.8 to $1.9 thousand billion of reserves. Next to China comes Japan with a trillion. Then, astonishingly, next comes Russia, or at least it did by the date of these reserve figures, which was in September. Although I was there last Monday, and they lost 45 million last month. So things are changing in Russia, and my guess is that that will be somewhat reduced. The Eurozone itself is about the same size as Russia. But then the remarkable thing is, and I mentioned this before, is that next comes India, worth $290 billion. And when I was in the game, India was a basket case. But now $290 billion. And so it goes. The United States is remarkably at $75 billion. $75 billion, it ranks number 23 in this foreign exchange reserves. But we can print the money, so I guess we have something that the others do not have. Although its impact on our economy is not unimportant. But China has done this because the trade of China is equivalent to about 80% of its GDP. In the United States, the equivalent figure is 25%. So China is this trading colossus, and it does it very well. And I think you know that the results have been pretty clear in terms of the way in which China has been able to manage this particular activity. The U.S. trade deficit to China is interesting because you know that it's gone up, but the fascinating part about it is that when you do an analysis of the trade deficit, the trade deficit to Asia has not increased. What has happened has been that you've had the other countries in Asia providing components and resources to China instead of exporting them to us. China has turned them around and they export them to us. So our deficit to China is our deficit to Asia has not changed. It is just that China has taken the game away from the other countries there. But they're not unhappy with it because they've got their business now with China. And the countries that, of course, have simply been displaced or changed their pattern is Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. That is now the framework in which we see this colossus emerging. But as Jeffrey Bader has recently said, what is significant is that now if China catches a cold, Asia catches a cold. And it's a pretty important day to be talking about that because the world has caught a cold in the last, I hope it's only a cold. It seems more than that at the moment. But in the last 2 months, we've seen economic activity in international trade and international investment just take a nosedive. And all the graphs that you see go like this until you get to September, and then they go like this. I have a place in Wyoming in Jackson Hole, and there is a meeting there of the Federal Reserve governors from around the world in the third week of August each year, and my family and I have had the pattern of inviting, or I have when I was at the bank, I would invite, excuse me, 15 or 20 of these leaders to dinner on the Friday night. And on the third week of August, we had a very nice dinner. There was a discussion held between people of great distinction. I won't name them, but they were the leaders of the international community. And the dinner was calm. A lot of wine was drunk. We talked about some bumps that there were in the market. But there was really no sense amongst this group of insiders of the precipitous drop that we then had in September and thereafter. And I think that the extent of that drop is taking a lot of people by surprise, not least the people that are running the system. And what we're seeing now is that the results of that precipitous decline will inevitably be converted and felt by other countries. And amongst those other countries will be China. Now, there is the issue always, is China self-sufficient? And can it do without exports to the United States? And I've heard figures been given even to me by Chinese officials which say, well, if U.S. goes to hell, it'll affect us by 1% of growth. I simply don't believe it. Because it's not just the United States. It is the totality of the international system to which China is linked. And I think that is the thing which all of us are now recognizing, that this current disturbance or crisis or whatever you want to call it in the market, I do not believe can be either ignored by China or will be not affecting China in a serious way. And this New York Times piece this morning, which talks of quarterly growth in the 5% range, is really quite dramatic for China watchers, because we've always thought, you know, they could manage it, it'll be 9%, and then maybe it's 8%. They'll never allow the numbers to go below 8%. There's a conventional wisdom, but that does not appear to be the case according to this report, which may be disavowed by the Chinese authorities, but which is nonetheless there this morning. We have a choice of how we deal with the Chinese, which I won't go into, although I at some point would like to. Maybe somewhere one of your other speakers can deal with the question of whether we have competition with them or we have cooperation. There are two ways in which you can deal with China. You can either attack them in every way through the international agencies about unfair trade practices, unfair labor practices, about their currency. You can go for them. Or the other way that you could deal with it is to say, let's join together and we have complementary skills and we are going to grow together. Let's see if we can cooperate. Probably the answer will be somewhere in the middle. But it's worth an hour's discussion to talk just about that question. And I'd recommend to you that you might at some subsequent time take a look at that. I had intended to talk to you, but I've now got to my time, about climate change and the crucial importance of that in relation to both our country and China, but more particularly to the world. The fact that China has become the largest CO2 emitter in the world, taken that marvelous position away from the United States. And when you look forward, the emissions of both China and India become a dramatic consideration to global growth and to global enjoyment. I was also going to talk to you about that issue that I raised, which was the 2 billion people in Africa and the changing dynamic between Africa and China and Africa and India. 2 years ago, you'll remember that China had for the first time a summit meeting of the African heads of state, which was held in Beijing at the same time as 400 business people went from Africa to India. And this nexus between China and India and Africa is becoming a new and significant nexus. What is interesting is that China forgave $10 billion of debt rather quietly, and they put up a couple of billion dollars a year. And they have attracted the attention of the Africans in a very significant way. I keep saying to my African friends, well, you do realize that the international institutions, mainly Western, forgave you $100 billion of debt and still come between $15 and $20 billion a year to Africa, but it's as though that doesn't exist now, because the latest game on the block is China and India. And they're doing a fantastic job, I have to say, in marketing themselves. And the third area that I had thought to get into, but don't have the time now, is what all this means for reform of global governance, what it means in terms of the UN, the international institutions, the GATT, the World Bank, and IMF. And if you invite me back in another 10 years, I'll tell you a little more about that. But it is those are the sort of subjects that I think might be valuable for you to think about in terms of this series. And I have now reached my time, and I'm told that there will either be 2 minutes of questions or 30 minutes of questions, and that's up to you. And so thank you for hearing me through on China. I hope that's given you a good...
We do have slightly more than 2 minutes for questions. Let me raise a first question, because I'm not going to let you go without addressing the global governance question entirely. We have next week a significant meeting here on the 15th of the G20, looking at the issues of global governance in the economic sector. China's clearly going to play, and India, to add your postscript, are clearly going to play important roles thereat. If you had to, if you were the architect of a fixed architecture for the Keystone Economic International Economic Organizations, what's the practical way forward? for that, that accommodates both the desires of Europeans and others for greater regulation and accommodates the apparent need for greater participation and responsibility by countries like China and India.
Well, I have a very clear view on that that I've been espousing for some time, in that I think that the G7 is outdated completely, and that from the figures I gave you, which were that they were the considerable part, 60% of the 75% of the global GDP, and it's going to drop to 35%, you'd have to be a lunatic not to think, well, who are the people that are going to assume those positions? And you'd have to be blind not to see China and India. You just have to be blind. And in the days when I was running the bank, we used to get invited to some of these big meetings, and we always got asked to the G7 meeting. And the first G7 meeting in Lyon, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, Nigeria, and I think one other country were asked to, was, what was it?
Evian.
At Evian, sorry, not Lyon, in Evian, just across the lake in Geneva, which was chaired by, who was the president of France? It was Chirac, wasn't it? He invited these people. He gave each of them 7 minutes to speak, and then we had lunch. So they were sort of welcomed as, in a sort of patronizing way, as only the French can do. And I hope this is not for press, by the way. I do want to go back to Paris. It was a very interesting meeting because Hu Jintao started in a very modest way and spoke about China, and then the Prime Minister of India spoke, I think in English. It was hard to understand him, but he was a very charming man, if not fully understandable. And then the newly elected Lula of Brazil got up, and he said, Mr. President, it's a great honor for me to be here with my colleagues from the developing countries. And my parents would be very thrilled if I knew I was here with you, President Bush, and you, President Putin, and you, President Chirac, and so on. And we'll have a photograph, and I'll take it back to my family. But I would like to say one thing, he said. He said, maybe next year you should think about having the meeting in Rio, and maybe the following year in Beijing, and the following year in Delhi, because you guys really should get used to the fact that in a few years' time, you're not going to be the G7. And in fact, many of you are not going to be here. So if you want to get used to this, why don't you start now by coming? It was a sort of joke, but it really addresses the question that you're speaking of. There is an inevitability about this. It is sheer nonsense to think of an elite club of seven people who meet however they meet, and not include China, India, Brazil, Russia, and a series of countries that you can easily speak of. I have to say that I favor a G20 because I know Australia will be in the G20 and that it may not be in something other than that. But either some G11, G12, G20, I think is an absolute necessity. And I think having the G7 meet without this and patronizing these other people is simple nonsense. That's my answer to your question.
We've got microphones coming. If you could stand or at least say who you are before you you ask your question.
Hi, my name is Hattie Babbitt, and I guess I'm asking this question as the Vice Chair of World Resources Institute. And I would like for Jim to talk some about climate change in China, and China and the United States in particular. The world won't get where it needs to go without the cooperation and activity of China and the United States. We're two carbon-intensive countries. We're too coal-intensive in our electricity production. And if you could, I'd like for you to talk a little bit about the role of the World Bank in terms of both mitigation and adaptation in developing countries and China.
Well, I think thanks, Hattie, for the question. It is a very serious question, and I think is something that if you have a China series, you probably want to spend a whole meeting on in terms of both environment and in terms of power and of natural resources, because China has a very serious issue in that it is a rapidly growing economy, as I've indicated by the numbers, and their major source of power is, in fact, coal. And they're opening one coal-fired plant a week, and because of that, and these coal-fired plants do not have appropriate methods of reduction of emissions, as you know, because that makes it more expensive. So they're banging these things up at a tremendously great rate, and therefore have taken on the leadership in terms of CO2 emissions. Now, the Chinese themselves are deeply worried about this. As you probably know, Hu Jintao himself and Wen Jiabao both said that this is at the very top, along with poverty, of the issues which they need to direct the environment in which they all live. But it is expensive. And it is an allocation of resources which they need to make. They're spending a tremendous amount of money looking at alternative sources of energy at the moment. That I know from personal experience. They're looking really at everything from solar to wind to the latest gadgets to create out of the environment energy. And yet those, even if they're successful, you're talking 4, 5, 6% of their energy needs. You're not dealing with the fundamental question of the CO2 emissions. So this is a question which is enormous in terms of China. It will be enormous in terms of the developing world in general, because they have not produced power to the level that their economic advances will need, and it's a problem which you have in your organization of how you can get an allocation of resources from governmental level to deal with the environment on something which is actually long-term, when the short-term needs is to get jobs and to get industry going. And most governments are myopic, and most governments get elected on short-term results, not on long-term, addressing long-term dangers. And this is not just, I think, a problem for China. I think it's a problem for all of us, and you're at the forefront of that in your organization and others. But I think in China it is dramatic because of the scale of the country. When you think it's going to grow from, 6-7% of global GDP to 20-plus percent of global GDP. And the population is growing extensively, and the world population is growing extensively. Everything is talking about ballooning the impact that is going to inevitably happen. So I think it's worth an hour's talk in one of your meetings, because I think it is a central issue for China. I think it's a central issue for us. Nick Stern, Lord Stern, has come out and said that the impact of all this, and I asked my guys to check it, actually, because I didn't believe that that's what he said, but they've confirmed to me this morning that he says that at the extreme, the impact of this can be 20% of GDP. And if that is true, and Nick's a pretty good guy, and I'm sure not making wild claims, but if it's anything like 20% or 15% of GDP. This is not just an issue for people who are concerned about the environment as a social issue. This becomes a central economic issue, and nowhere is it more important and more caused than in China. And so I think you put your finger on an issue, but I would urge CSIS to spend a whole day on that question, because I think its impact is not just for the Greens. It is hugely important economically, and becomes a central issue, I think, for the United States and China.
We'll take you up on that just here.
You might get Nick Stern to come for that, by the way.
Thank you. I'm Don Shirk from SAIS. President Wolfensohn, is there any parallel or lessons that we can learn from 1944 where it was just Britain and the United States that were able to put together the architecture of the fund and the bank? We had two central characters, John Maynard Keynes and Harry Dexter White. The world has changed, as you've said, drastically. But the other day I was at a meeting with David Dollar, and I asked him, which country in the world does China most look to? And he said, the United States. So in a sense, there may be the blueprint there for China and U.S. cooperation. I'd like your reaction to that.
Well, I think, first of all, taking your last point first, I think in the scale of things that I would have presented to you and talked about, I don't think that the alternative of China and the United States fighting on everything is a viable alternative. And I think that we are seeing, in the event, a much closer proximity between China and the United States because their interests coalesce. And if my figures are anything like right, and I think directionally they certainly are right, then come 2030 or 2035, China's GDP will exceed that of the United States. So the notion that the two of these countries don't get together would be absurd, just absurd. And there are things more than GDP that are involved. There is Asia. There is the knowledge base that goes with it. There is the whole political framework in which we're operating with a shift towards Asia that has to be encompassed. And I think having an understanding with China, and I would add India as well, but particularly China in this next 20 years is absolutely crucial. Now, as to the structure of the IMF and the World Bank, I think I'm right in saying that China managed to get another half or 1% and pushed it up to 3 or 4%, maybe not even that much, of the capital of the bank. Does anybody know? 3.5%. And you know, that's a nice concession to them, and they have a better office now, I notice, at the bank. But it's not yet recognizing the balance. The bank and the fund suffer from the same history as the G7. They're instruments of the G7 in the sense that they were created with their centrality around the rich G7 countries. I'm not passing negative judgments on the G7 for what they did or anything. I mean, I think they did a fantastic job. I think the United States has done a terrific job. But if my figures are anywhere near right, and they will be near right, it is nonsensical to think that if you move from 75% of global GDP down to 35% of global GDP in terms of those rich countries, and these other countries are coming up to approach, in the case of two of them, close to 50% of global GDP by 2050, the notion that they're not central in terms of the planning process of the bank and the fund is ridiculous. Now, maybe you phase it in over 5 years or 7 years, but it needs a complete review. And I think the dominance of the leadership, now that I was appointed by the United States, they can appoint Indians and anybody else they want. I'm really making the point that the United States at the moment appoints the head of the World Bank, and typically Europe appoints the head of the fund. That will change at some point. And at the moment, when you have China with $1.9 trillion of reserves, you ought to at least make a concession to China that they become the most important financial repository in the world. So I think there is a need for change, and I think there are a lot of people who think that, and maybe in a new administration that will be possible. I don't know.
Way in the back between the cameras.
Peter Sharfman, MITRE Corporation. We hear a lot about how the Chinese view the United States and view the G7. What do the Chinese think about the future of India? Do they share your perception?
To be quite honest with you, I don't think I can give you a good answer on that. I'm out of date in terms of discussions that I've had with the Chinese about India. And I've had discussions with the Indians about the Chinese, and I think they recognize that there is a need. Manmohan Singh, as you know, went to China and is looking for ways in which they can build relationships. But I think any answer I could give you would be pretty superficial. I think the two of them have to work out a way of coming together. They are, after all, going to be the two dominant powers, but I have no recent experience of discussions with the Chinese or the Indians about that subject, so I would be guessing at this moment.
I will say that the Chinese are rapidly building up their capacity to deal with India, so at least from that measure, there's a recognition of the importance, but it's still very superficial. So just here in the second row.
I wondered, get back to short-term issues, what you believe U.S.-China and Bretton Woods institutions need to do to help us get out of this financial and economic crisis?
Well, I think the financial and economic crisis has not been caused by China-U.S. relations. I think it has been caused by excesses in our country and to a degree in other countries. But we're now in a mess because the largest economy in the world, ours, has run into problems that were possibly predictable. We had a savings rate that was zero to negative. We had a spending rate of 130% of income. And we had a development of securities which were significantly in the mortgage-related area, which came into trillions of dollars, which were understood by the mathematicians who invented them, but were not comprehensible to most people, but they nonetheless were significantly traded and in huge orders of magnitude and were not adequately reported in the banking scene. That was a menu for what we've had today, and we're now paying the price. There are excesses all around and lack of supervision and rating agencies going along with the fiction that these things were AAA. And that series of assumptions and actions is now bust. The emperor is seen to have no clothes. And we're all about to suffer from it. We are suffering from it. And I don't think that we can do anything to help China in the United States or building that relationship absent this other far more overlaying economic crisis which we're going through. And I think the information this morning that China's GDP for the fourth quarter is estimated at 5-point-something% is an indication that the world is flat. This is like no economic crisis that I've seen before. And I think we have to live through it, but I think everyone's going to get hit. It would amaze me if the assertions that China can do without the United States and that its impact will only be 1%, which is conventional wisdom by some Chinese scholars, I think, or was put out actually mainly by Chinese public officials, is likely to be correct. So I think we're at the beginning of something which is much bigger than China and the United States. I think we're in the midst of a major financial disturbance.
Just here in the second row here. I'm sorry. This gentleman's been waiting.
My name is Pramod Malhotra. I'm with Global Finance Associates. Mr. Wolfenson, thank you for a most wonderful, wide-ranging analysis of where we are. I had one question for you about Africa. During our lifetime, we've seen people in the Middle East go from camel drivers to the richest in the world. I wonder why the same couldn't happen in Africa, where the raw materials are going to be the real repository of a lot of wealth. And we could see an enormous increase in incomes, GDP, and their population compared to their size and resources actually small. I'd like your views on that.
Well, I think if you could start with Africa with a team of experienced and not starry-eyed administrators and economists and planners and managers, you could do a fantastic job with Africa. The problem is it's divided into 53 countries. At least half of them are under 10 million. I think it's 31. I've forgotten the number, but it's something of that order. I'm not an expert on corruption, but I have traveled widely with my wife in Africa. And we had a very simple test when we would go to the president's house, prime minister's house for dinner or whatever it is, that if they were wearing a Rolex watch or better, if the wife was wearing Dior or equivalent clothes and jewelry, and if the first claim was that we have a fantastic chef from Paris, you knew the country was in for deep trouble. And unfortunately, that was the case in all too many countries. And so the issue of governance is really central to the question of Africa. And it's not a trivial issue. It is a continent that's being wildly screwed up. And if you look individually at the countries which have the major resources, and I just take Nigeria as an example, and you look at what's happening to Nigeria at the moment, you have to put your head in your hands and say, this is tragedy. I hope John Kufuor, who was the president of Ghana, came up with a terrific plan. He was just president of the African Union for a coming together. I spent a lot of time talking to him about it a few months ago, and his plan was, let's take 10 years to get to a European Union-type government in Africa. Let's give the boys a chance to steal what they want, but let's have the next generation come in on the basis of merit and properly being paid. Let's start by dividing the continent up into quarters and then bring them together into a unified group with a proper plan over 10 years to try and bring it together so that we can have some sort of increase in quality of governance and control. And I don't know whether Kufuor's plan is the right plan, but something like that is needed, because the tragedy is that this is a continent with amazing resources and all the potential in the world, and it's just being screwed up. Now, one of the difficulties that we have at the moment is in the relationship between Chinese and American companies and their African counterparts. At the present time, although this has not been true historically, America has found religion in terms of governance in Africa. That was not always so, by the way, particularly in the Cold War times. We were quite prepared to accept a lot of things. But we've found religion recently. China and the United States come together on the states that have failed or that are failing in terms of trying to help them. When they're healthy states with natural resources, it is at least claimed that the approach to corruption and governance is different, and that the Chinese, to put it at its best, say you should run the country the way you want and we'll deal with it, whereas the Americans and the World Bank and others are looking at trying to bring better governance and fight corruption and so on. I think that there is quite a lot of truth in that. And for those countries that are natural resource rich, China is becoming the natural partner. And in those countries, the intrusion of people like the bank and the fund and do-gooders from our country is really that we don't have much leverage because they're moving to financing from China. That is a conventional wisdom. I make no comment on whether I believe it or not, but I'm saying it, so I guess I believe it. But I think it's more true than untrue, unfortunately. And Kufuor did not get, he could not get his report considered at the OAU. And he was chairman.
We'll go in the back and then we'll come up front. I think we've got time for a couple more questions.
Thank you. I am Nestor Iqueda, an associate reporter for Latin America. President Wolfenson, you spoke about China and all other regions in the world, but you escaped Latin America. And some 3 years ago, when the president who was on his way to Santiago for the APEC summit, and he stopped over Brazil and Argentina to announce about $100 billion in investments. And most recently, China has strengthened its relations, trade, and military relations with Venezuela. And my question is, how do you see the China's presence in Latin America, and if you believe the U.S. should take China in Latin America as an enemy or a competitor?
Well, I didn't speak about China because I was asked to speak about. I didn't speak about Latin America because I wasn't asked to talk about it. I have a separate speech somewhere that I could give you on Latin America. I just don't happen to have it with me. But I, of course, deeply moved by the developments in Latin America, and China has adopted, so far as I know in Latin America, a constructive policy on natural resources. They're very keen to take advantage of the natural resources, and they're also having a constructive policy on exports. And if you look at Latin America, Chinese exports are everywhere. On Venezuela, I think I should say I don't know. It's a country that I actually knew very well. But since the new administration came in, it's not so new administration in Venezuela, I was there once and decided not to go back. So I have no idea what is the relationship between China and Venezuela. But it would not surprise me if, as a matter of keeping people off balance, that the Chinese and the Venezuelans are getting closer together. But I'm ignorant on the subject, so I can't really give you a useful comment. If you would come to my speech at the when I give a speech, if I'm ever asked at the Inter-American Council, I will have prepared an answer for you, but I don't have one today.
Let's come up to the front row.
My name is Martin Apple. I'm the president of the Council of Scientific Society Presidents, representing a very large science community. The issue of global climate change and coal-fired power plants are really a symptom of what we have as a major global issue. That's living sustainably. We're depleting all of the fisheries around the globe and turning our oceans back a million years in evolution and so forth. We're doing this all over. Now, if India, China, and the United States are going to be the big three of the next 25 and 50 years, unless we can develop a paradigm of living sustainably, they won't continue. That is, the whole biosystem that we depend on will go bankrupt, and when it files Chapter 11, so does everything else. So we really have to learn a new way of thinking as we do this development, not just solving the problem of coal-fired power plants today.
Well, I agree with you completely. I am spending my time since I've left the bank addressing that question. I was asked by the president of the World Bank to chair a group of eight countries that are working with Conservation International on exactly this issue, and we have our first meeting with me as chairman next Monday. And my own private activities with my kids is exactly on this issue. So I didn't mention it today because I wasn't asked to talk about it, but it's a subject on which I could talk a lot, and I agree 100% with you on your analysis, and regret very much that more people are not addressing it. But I would make one point on the China and India question, is that they regard at the moment that issue as a luxury. They are looking at short-term economic development, which I'm sure you know. And so they say that's for our successors, but if we don't get there in terms of economic advance, then we can't generate the resources that we need to deal with the issue of environment, and we can't hold back economic development. And I think that that issue is a really crucial issue for these countries. But the truth of the matter is that in the short term, people understand jobs. They don't see the problem of environmental degradation 10, 15 years from now. Although how anybody can live in China and not in the major cities, given that 17 out of 20 of them are the most polluted cities in the world, and not see that this is an issue, astonishes me. But even with that, people still want to get a job. And they're prepared not to see the sky if they can get a job. And it is a real tough issue, and I agree with your analysis completely and don't know what to do about it, but I'm doing my best.
President Wilfinson has other calls in his time, so I'm afraid we'll have to let that be the final word. I really want to thank everybody for coming, and please join me in thanking James Wilfinson.